Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend Jim Brines, the beloved physician in the community, he's a member of the long-term member of the UNC Medical School faculty. Perhaps more than anything else, a wonderful mentor to other doctors and other healthcare providers. Dr. Brian, with his colleagues, has brought us a history of the Department of Medicine at the Carolina Medical School. It's called Medicine at Chapel Hill, the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, 1952 to 2007. I got him here to talk about the book and to talk about medical training and medical care in our community and in the country. Dr. Brian, thanks for coming.
I'm glad to be here, D.G., and it's an honor.
Well, it's I look forward to it. There's so many things I want to talk to you about. I'm going to try to stay on for a minute or two, at least stay on the book. We had one of your colleagues, Bill McClendon, was active in writing a book which was sort of the history of the medical school. Why do you need a history of the department?
Well,
a department of medicine in the
in medicine, the Department of Medicine is the clinical site of training and is the major teaching arm for the medical school in clinical medicine. Medicine was the identity of the physicians that graduated up till the 20th century, and he became interested in either surgery or pediatrics or one of those. but fundamentally, you are a physician, and medicine means physician, and so this history was engendered by the fact that 50 years had passed since the clinical medical school had reopened in 1952 after the Good Health Movement. My friend Bill McClendon, who was the second editor of this book, actually had knows what he was doing. But I was going to help Bill Blythe write it by helping interview the original six people who came here to found the clinical Department of Medicine. And I had started on that, and then Bill had a tragic death. And I had these notes, and the older original people were beginning to die. And I said, we need to get this underway before I die. And so when Bill agreed to do this with me, I undertook this task, and I had those notes, and I started from there and outlined what I thought was a reasonable way to present the picture of the 55 years. By that time, it had been 55 years. The school had asked all the departments to write a 50-year anniversary book, and there's a listing in the back of this book of all the various departments, and ours was the only major one that had not written one. Now, our department was the mother department of several other departments later on. For instance, out of our department was spawned the Department of Neurology, the Department of Dermatology, the Department of Family Medicine, the Department of Emergency Medicine, and Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, just to name a few. And the size of the school and its scope and its research and the physicians involved in the educational process as well as the care process exploded in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and so that now, not counting those that other departments that I mentioned, there are over 300 full-time faculty listed in the Department of Medicine itself, and so from six went to over 300, plus those that went into these other departments that I just named.
Let me, to put it in perspective, you really give a preliminary history of the medical school to put yours in context, but beginning in the 1950s, the department how was the medical school constructed, and where did the Department of Medicine fit, and what were the other departments
right.
at that point?
The reason that the school reopened its second and third and fourth year arms and started giving again the MD degree, this had been given up till 1910 when the famous Flexner report said that the clinical teaching in our school was inadequate, and we closed down and started just doing the basic science years and sending the young people off to places like Penn and Jefferson and Richmond and Harvard to
finish
their MBs.
Well, I want to interrupt you because I noticed in your book that Bill Blythe, who inspired this book, he went to a place that's now famous on this campus because he left Chapel Hill to go to Washington.
Washington University, that's right. He went out to Washington University, which several people did. Then he came back, spent the rest of his career here.
So the medical school was in transformation in terms of moving back into a four-year mode, and they organized the Department of Medicine. What were the other departments?
The other departments at that time, of course, were surgery and OBGYN and psychiatry, and those were the major clinical departments that were reestablished.
Everybody else who wasn't a surgeon or OBGYN or a psychiatrist was in medicine.
And pediatrics.
Pediatrics.
Yes, that's correct.
And so it was this was where a doctor was going to be trained.
That's where the doctors were trained. That's correct. And that's how you learn to deal and practice medicine in the 1952. This school was stimulated by the fact that in 1940, when the draft started, North Carolina was second from last to the amount of number of folks that were eligible for the draft because of the deferments because of poor health. And it turned out that this argument was used to say that the fact that the boys from the orphanages had only a 3% rejection rate and the average rejection rate for draftees was 46% in North Carolina created the good health movement. And the good health movement was the popular arm that, along with a lot of other things, enabled the politicians to see that they needed to open up more medical training and create more doctors for North Carolina. And that's what led to this. At that point, there were two other medical schools here, Duke and Wake Forest, but they had very small classes, and they had only been around for about 20 years.
So when the medical school was 2 years, was there a Department of Medicine then?
No, there were physicians in the student health service that taught things like physical diagnosis, but there was no clinical teaching beside those physicians introducing the young people to physical diagnosis over at Watts Hospital.
Well, Jim, just trying to get my arms around what a Department of Medicine is, and you're telling me this is the primary teaching vehicle for regular doctors in their third and fourth years.
That's correct.
Clinical
medicine. And at this point, after the 50s and 60s, the Department of Medicine, along with the rest of the country, started recognizing subspecialties in medicine. And then, therefore, there became cardiologists and pulmonologists and nephrologists and endocrinologists. All these are part of the Department of Medicine. These organ-specified specialists. Now, before that, you were an internist, you had internal medicine and general medicine, and with an interest in one of those fields. And the subspecialty boards in America weren't really established till the 60s and 70s, so there was no such thing as a cardiologist, although the American College of Cardiology was established in the 50s. There was the American College of Physicians, which was the premier recognition for internal medicine was established in the 1916.
So at least if we think of the Department of Medicine training internist primarily.
That's correct.
Is that
close? The recognition. That's correct. And they were responsible for doing that by having residents come into their training program and man the hospital and be under supervision for 3 years. And then they were eligible, therefore, for the boards in internal medicine.
I see. So their training in this area of medicine begins in the third and fourth year. And then if someone decides to remain in internal medicine or one of the affiliated practices, they need to find a place where there's a training for residents.
That's right. And so our students, a few of them stayed, but most of them went off to other places under our stimulus because we wanted them to see that medicine was practiced basically the same, but they also needed to see the world and get a feel for medicine in general in the United States.
We're visiting with Jim Brown. We're talking about a new book, Medicine at Chapel Hill, the Department of Medicine and the University of North Carolina, 1952 to 2007. Jim Brown is one of the collectors, editors, organizers, managers of that book, and he's very happy that it's done. He'll tell us more about it after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Dr. Jim Brown is my guest. He is one of the three listed editors and contributors to Medicine at Chapel Hill, a new book that takes the history of that department at the School of Medicine from 1952 to 2007. Jim, you're listed as an editor, but you wrote most of it, didn't you?
No, I just framed it up, and I wrote a lot of the introductory parts. And my main job was to flog the contributors, and these contributors were the folks from each of the divisions that I mentioned a little bit back that were currently active. And then I would ask folks that would write about the departments as they evolved, such as the Department of Neurology and Dermatology, to write up a section.
You know, in every organization, they're the strong people, the leaders, the people who that you say, if it hadn't been for that person, it just never would have happened. And are there people like that in the Department of Medicine, or is everybody just sort of a cooperative group of people who get along well, and you don't need any people to whip them in line?
Well, if you define yourself by becoming an academic medicine person, you need some sort of recognition of selfhood beyond, because you're not going to make any money. And so you might as well get recognized by titles and programs and things that you do, as well as the grants that you get. But as I mentioned, the six original folks were that came into the department. They were enlisted by Dean Berryhill, who is the giant. He was an internist, and he came down here and was a student health physician and appointed dean after Dr. McNider retired in the 1940s. And he led the charge with the Good Health Movement to let the legislature, along with the Hill-Burton federal money, get the money for the hospital. And he insisted that the hospital be in Chapel Hill, which at that time was a sleepy little village. And then he talked some of the young giants in medicine into coming down. And the first chairman of
these medicine.
Are guys that had decided to stay in academics and do research and think of themselves as scholar clinicians. And these were folks that had the World War II experience and were just on the cusp of being able to tap into the federal money that was becoming available through the NIH grants. And the first chairman was Dr. Charles Burnett, and he was already a shining example of academic medicine up in Boston. And Dean Berryhill, who had had his MD degree from Harvard and that had gone to Western Reserve, knew the old boy network and knew these people who were going to be rising stars. And so he enlisted Dr. Burnett, who in turn brought his friend Tom Farmer, a neurologist, with him, and enlisted people as disparate as Bill Cromarty, who just died last week, who was actually a pathologically trained internist and was interested in microbiology, and Dr. Palmer, Jeffrey Palmer, who was trained by the giant of hematology, Max Wintrobe, out in Utah. And he came in hematology, and Ernest Craig had gone here to gone here to undergraduate school, had won a Rhodes Scholarship, but wasn't able to activate it because of the war, and had gone up to Harvard, and was a gifted artist as well as a cardiologist. And he came down here to head the cardiology department.
How did Dr. Berryhill persuade these giants, as you call them, to leave established positions and come to a poor state where the
Excited about the possibility of creating a med school in which they could be make their stamp. And they opened the hospital. And as they opened the hospital, Dr. Cromarty opened the microbiology lab where all the cultures were done. Dr. Palmer made up all the IV solutions and created the blood bank. Another, it was a beginning. It was an opportunity to see growth.
So Dr. Berryhill's pitch was, come down here.
And help me create a medical school. And these people caught the vision and came down, and they quickly enlisted folks who, because of their personalities and their wisdom and their brightness, they wanted to come down and work with them. One of the giants, of course, was Louis Welt, who was a second chairman of the Department of Medicine. Louis Welt was already had an established research career at Yale, and he came down and he brought his chief technician Gloria Blythe, who at that point named Nassif, who met Bill Blythe and married him. Dr. Welt was a fantastic, at that point it wasn't called nephrology, it was called metabolism. And then he enlisted one of the absolute giants in nephrology called Carl Gottschalk. And there's a great collection of Carl Gottschalk's writings in the Wilson Library. And Carl Gottschalk did some very fundamental research on the function of the kidney, which is still mentioned so much.
Well, Jim, excuse me for interrupting you, but you talked about the Department of Medicine that's developing as primarily engaged in training practicing physicians, internists. But I hear you talking about research and
right, and the business about an academic institution needs three stools: research, teaching, and service. And of course, the service aspect was the reason that the hospital, it was called North Carolina Memorial Hospital, was built. And on the front of the hospital was a sign that says "Built by and for the people of the state of North Carolina." And this, of course, was the leading edge for medicine in North Carolina, and especially giving access to the poor to get at that kind of medicine that was then becoming available. Now, you remember that the hospital itself was built in the time when the state said there shall be no air-conditioned state buildings. And so the hospital built in the 50s was un-air-conditioned. And it wasn't until the 60s, when a state senator's wife got hot in there, that the air conditioning came in. That's exactly right. And it's interesting how things happen. It really is a fascinating thing to go back and watch all of these issues occur, and the growth, and how you plan for the growth, and the book itself has a picture on the front of the original hospital, and then on the back flyleaf there's a picture of the hospital as it now stands, with up in one corner is the original hospital, and there's a huge area for all the hospitals and research buildings that are now part of the enterprise.
Well, you talked about these first, I guess, six heroes who came down and organized this medical school. It wasn't all that long afterwards that you came.
Oh, I came 10 years, 10 or 15.
And were they still here?
I've been here in 64. Yes, they were all here. They were all here. None of them died. I shook hands with Dr. Burnett, who was ill at that point, and he died shortly after I came.
What was it that persuaded you to come?
Well, I had been trained at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was interested in the process of teaching. And my grandfather had been a physician, but my father wasn't. And I was just trying to define what medicine was in my own mind. And I perceived that I would have more fun in a place where the limits of medicine were being explored, and that I could teach students. And Dr. T. Franklin Williams met me when I was up visiting my brother, who was here in cardiology fellowship, and he said, if you want to come and teach and do clinical medicine, you're welcome, because I had the opportunity to go elsewhere, but they wanted me to get a PhD or whatever. But he enabled me to get a master's of public health, which was a natural for me, since I just had 2 years in the public health service. And it's evolved from there, and I'm entering my 50th year at the hospital at this point.
Well, it was interesting to me. I didn't know you had your MPA until I saw your identification in the book. I should have known that before. And did you get that here?
Yeah, I got it here, along with running the clinics and teaching medical students.
You're just saying you're going to school on the side.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. It was fun. But you can do a lot of things when you're young.
We're visiting with Dr. Jim Bryan about a book that he's responsible for with two other colleagues called Medicine at Chapel Hill, the Department of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, 1952 to 2007. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin talking to Dr. Jim Bryan, and we're talking in the context of a new book called Medicine at Chapel Hill. Dr. Bryan is one of the editors and a contributor to the book. He's given a lot of credit already to his colleague, Bill McClendon. And I've heard the two of you say that you couldn't have done it without Catherine Savage, who was...
Yeah, Catherine is a longstanding friend and is the daughter of a newspaper person from Alabama and has a gimlet eye and will not let a poorly placed comma go by. She is responsible for shining up the book and putting it together.
Jim, tell us, an institutional history is hard because you got to mention everybody and follow the progress, the organization, the little details. Sometimes it's hard, harder to get in the real good stories. Did you leave out any of the real good stories?
Well, a lot of the stories came by having sidebars on some of the folks who had come here through here and were influenced by being here. For instance, Francis Collins, the current head of the National Institutes of Health, was enlisted by Chris Fordham to come here after he'd already had his PhD and to become a medical student. And so he came and stayed on to do his medicine training and was so evidently bright and super that he was chief resident here. And the person he was chief resident with claimed that John Parker, claimed that he couldn't have done his year as acting chairman without Francis. But Francis is a sidebar. We also have sidebars on other folks. I mentioned T. Franklin Williams, who left here and became head of the National Institutes of Aging. I mentioned, I will mention that Oliver Smithies, who is brought down here, has been very much involved with the Department of Medicine, particularly in some of the basic research.
Can I jump in? This is, of course, Dr. Smithies is the Nobel Prize winner, and you'd never know that he was such a famous man because he's just as nice as can be. But now, just going back to the primary basis of the Department of Medicine is in training practitioners to be good general doctors. How far can you get in research, this genetic research and everything like the kind that Dr. Smithies is involved in, and still stay in the boundaries of
it's very, of very medicine? Difficult. Our people who are doing the research have to compete for dollars from various and sundry sources at this point, mainly the NIH, but it looks like that'll stop pretty soon. And they need to spend time in their labs and run their labs. On the other hand, the young people that are coming through the wards need to have clinicians who are comfortable with all this new knowledge that's being generated and who can show them how to apply it in the care of their patients. And this, of course, gets very complicated as the list of drugs increases from, 50 available drugs in the 50s to 5,000 now. And I want to make sure that the application of those pharmacies, for instance, don't get messed up. And there are great, huge efforts in terms of trying to avoid mistakes in giving drugs, and the actual nursing care has been complicated, and it's a very difficult and changed scene from when we used to have these unair-conditioned wards with 20 people on them, and your degree of sickness was a function of how close you were to the nursing station because there was no intensive care units at that point. There's no point in it because there were the observations that were being made were clinical. There were no silicone chip had not been invented, and therefore you couldn't have a monitoring of your online monitoring of your heartbeat, et cetera. And so you didn't need these specialized nurses that could watch the screen and say, this man is in serious trouble or this woman is in serious trouble. Please come, you see. And so it's fascinating. At the same time, there's been a huge evolution of the needs for clinical hospital work. For instance, during these 50 years, tuberculosis has disappeared. Polio has disappeared. The approach to GI disease has entirely changed because we can now have access to look down there and make changes in people's ulcers, and we have a series of ways to approach illnesses that we can't. Cardiology has entirely changed.
How do you mean?
Well, for instance, before 1954, there was no pump. There was barely heart operations for valve operations, and the effective oxygenation of someone in surgery was limited. Beginning in 64, there was a capacity to take pictures of the coronary arteries and therefore realized that some of these arteries were closing off. And beginning in the 80s, there's a capacity to open those arteries up without surgery, with a stent. I mean, on and on and on. When I went to medical school, there was no closed chest cardiac massage. There was a famous surgeon in Cleveland who had been on the golf course with his friend who dropped dead, and he opened the man's chest and brought him back. So we all in house staff training carried a knife with us. Fortunately, I never had to use that.
So the house staff at the hospital carried
knives until 1962. And that's when closed chest cardiac massage was introduced.
And so the idea was that in case of a
cardiac arrest,
no electronic device or anything, just a knife and you'd reach in and massage the heart to get it going.
That's correct.
Did you really believe you could do that?
Well, it was exhibited and talked about and written about.
I didn't ask you that.
I believed I could do it, uh-huh. But unfortunately, I was never called to do it. I was called down to someone who had in my hospital at the University of Pennsylvania, who had fainted in the beauty as a nurse supervisor, had fainted in the chair in the beauty shop, and she was unconscious, and I pulled her down to the floor and reached for my knife, and she said, "What are you doing, young man?"
No, I mean,
as close as I got.
It was kind of dangerous in those hospitals.
Very dangerous.
And what took the place of the knife?
The closed chest cardiac massage, which was introduced.
I have no idea what that is.
That's called CPR.
Okay.
And so that process was worked out in the 60s by Hopkins with studies.
So it'd be just as good to massage it without
opening the chest. That's correct. And that's been evolving over the years, too.
I'm sorry I can't let loose of this, but I mean, the idea that you've got a human being on the ground and you're trying to not just open the skin. Isn't that, I mean,
you have to go between the ribs and grab the chest, heart.
You've got to cut off a rib.
We had to go just spread it apart with your hand.
Okay.
All right. In any case, that's past tense, and we have other ways of keeping people alive till we can do something definitive about their problem, be it establish an airway or be it whatever it might be that might prolong their life. I actually have four patients who have, quotation marks, dropped dead, and they were in this fortuitous place, like at the Dean Dome, where the emergency medical service was there, and they were being brought over to the hospital, and the studies were done, and a stent was put into their coronary arteries, and they're doing fine. And one other one dropped dead working out at Metamont, and you know, I saw him yesterday at church, and so
he dropped dead in the sense that his heart stopped.
That's correct.
And what?
It would not have been brought back 30, 40 years ago.
And the key is keeping
the heart muscle oxygenated and the brain oxygenated and getting them where they can see why the heart has stopped.
So the care in the emergency vehicle can do kinds of things.
All that evolved too. When I first came, the emergency vehicle was Walker's funeral home ambulance, but that evolved in the 60s and 70s. Tom Griggs. Herb, it's escaping me, the surgeon who had come from Vietnam established the Emergency Medical Service, and it's been fantastic, and this we're blessed. And, you know, they've tied it in with the 911 now, and so you get, you know, within minutes response when you call.
It's a great place to have a fatal heart attack, but you might survive it.
That's right. You might make it.
Well, we're visiting with Dr. Jim Bryan. We're talking to him in connection with the new book, Medicine at Chapel Hill. He's one of the editors, and he and I will be back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Jim Bryan is my guest, Dr. Jim Bryan, and we're talking about Medicine at Chapel Hill. That's a new book. Jim is I think it's fair to say the leading editor, but his buddy, Dr. Bill McClendon, and his friend, Catherine Savage, also listed as editors. And then you had a whole host of contributors.
Absolutely. That's where they came from.
But I'm interested in the context of writing the history and looking back to 1952, we talked about some of the incredible advances that make our ability to have a long and healthy life a greater ability. But are you satisfied with where the practice of medicine is going in Chapel Hill?
That's a complicated question because I think we can match the quality of medicine in the United States, but most of us in the practice of medicine are very unhappy about the way medicine is organized and the way that the system has been evolving so that particular people are not being cared for adequately. And so the idea of the organization of medicine and the payment for medical services has been under stress. Blue Cross Blue Shield was formed in the 30s. But when the hospital opened, the hospital room charge was $10, which was all inclusive for X-rays and labs. And now the costs are up in the thousands because
thousands of dollars.
Yeah, including and the particular technologies that have come online, including MRIs and PET scans and CAT scans and all the cardiac issues that I just talked about. Are very, very costly. And the machines are costly. They have to be paid for. The people who run the machines have to be paid for. The availability has to be there. And the drugs that we use have basically evolved in my lifetime. The whole field of oncology, for instance, has opened up. There's a wonderful book I might mention, if it's okay.
Yeah.
Called The Emperor of All Maladies. That's a story of the treatment of cancers in the last 50 years, which by Muharjee, and it's a fascinating book. And the technologies and the approaches to diseases that are now available, you know, include things that are advertised on the evening news, like Embril, for instance, which is a $5,000 a month shot. I mean, it's easy to prescribe that, but getting people to pay for it, getting the system to pay for it, is another issue.
Well, are you worried about the cost?
I'm worried not that we have new things to do, but how does the person who is in an economic situation that it does not allow him to have insurance. And in our situation, the coverage for people without insurance is inadequate, as you've discussed in our country, until we can get a situation where everyone can have some coverage and we can define what is good medicine and what is appropriate medicine. And should the last 3 months of life consume 80% of the Medicare costs for that person? And, you know, how do we deal ethically and appropriately?
These are
for
questions rather than directions. So,
absolutely.
So, unless we've got an alternative, it's hard to be too critical of what we've got that is developed unless we've got some good program to
right. And those of us who came to UNC to see that the people of the state of North Carolina had access to good care are frustrated. And we know that a lot of the costs are extraneous. For instance, if you have, it's been well proven that if you have good primary care, in other words, you have access to a physician, and you don't go to an emergency room, which is under the gun of finding the diagnosis more than healing the patient and applying expensive, effective, and sensitive technologies to you, the cost of emergency room care is horrible, and it could be probably accomplished. A lot of it could be accomplished by having a primary physician who you could contact and say, I have this, that, or the other, and he could either reassure or say, we need to do this or that.
So just pushing you a little bit, the main thing that you would like to see is for everybody in the country to have a primary doctor.
I would like that, yeah. And who is going to be adequately cared for, adequately reimbursed.
And what's in the way of that right now?
Well, right now, there are a lot of things in the way. For instance, the cost of medical education has escalated to the point that young people getting out of medical school have on average a debt of about $100,000. And that makes it very difficult for them to think about becoming medical missionaries or to become primary care doctors. And the primary care doctors, the difference between the primary care doctor salary and the salary of one of the specialists is, you know, a factor of five. It's the same thing as the excess payment of executives in our country. It's the same kind of dynamic where intellect and effectiveness are not measured in the same way.
So what do you do?
I'm not sure. I think that the reason that people continue to go into primary care and continue to have this profession of medicine is that it is so fulfilling. It is still a wonderfully fulfilling profession, and you know your people are grateful for the attention they get, and realize that that you with your the doctor with his capacity to have access to these various ways of relieving suffering can really help you maintain your health. And so there are a lot of factors that are going into the dearth of or the misorganization. Now, whether or not we'll ultimately end up with you and I having a nurse practitioner who will decide whether or not you need to see a doctor or not is an interesting
mm-hmm. Are you
sidebar.
Are you comfortable with? No system's perfect, but moving towards the basic caregiver or connection to the medical establishment being someone less educated than the
we invented the nurse practitioner program here at UNC in the Department of Medicine in 1968. We created the nurse practitioners, and that was a very effective way for us to deal with folks with chronic needs or chronic dependency needs keep us going on the acute issues mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. needed some more experience or more higher degree of medical care. Team medicine is the part of the answer. Now, whether you can establish a team with the help of some electronic trick, I'm not sure. I think that the electronics that we're entering into, e-medicine and the e-records, are going to be very helpful. For instance, if all of us had a chip around our neck with all of our medical data on it, that whoever you encounter, a practitioner, he could put this in his machine and could see your last cardiogram or where you stood a week ago in terms of various measures, it would make for very efficient medicine. Mm. So I think it's fun to watch this process evolve. It's also interesting to muse about how to deal with the real and inevitable processes that take us on as we go through the years. like the aging issues is what I'm talking about.
I'm getting more and more interested in that.
Yeah, getting more and more interested in that. And the business about how to offset some of the suffering of becoming older by exercise or whatever it might be.
I'm real interested in that. and I want you to come back and talk to me just about aging and the positive sides of it if you can. In the meantime, thank you for working so hard to bring out this book on the history of the Department of Medicine at Chapel Hill and taking time to talk to us about it today.
So glad to, D.G.
Thanks to Dr. Jim Bryan. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin. It's been Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.